From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. In 2002, Talkers magazine rated Don Imus the third greatest radio or TV talk show host of all time, behind Rush Limbaugh and Howard Stern, and ahead of Larry King. Heard on 90 radio stations and simulcast on MSNBC, Imus in the Morning reaches roughly 3.5 million people every single week, or used to reach. He's been canned because last week he said something sexist and racist and indisputably offensive, but of course, he or his staff did that every week.
Matter of fact, both teams played most of the game like a bunch of polio-stricken bitches last night. Matter of fact, the Knicks got booed more in their own house than Rosie O'Donnell in the live sex show, I'm a man.
It had to be one heck of a slow news week for the media to be shocked by a show hiding in plain sight for decades, raking in mountains of cash. It made its fortune with a two-part format. One part reveling in sex and routinely offending blacks, gays, and women, and one that hosted highbrow political discussion with the media elite. Tim Russert, Jeff Greenfield, and Frank Rich regularly appeared on that part, and if the show hadn't been killed, they probably would have again. As CBS newsman and Imus regular Bob Schieffer told The Washington Post this week, "I'm not going to sever a relationship with someone who has apologized for what he said. I hate what he did, but he's still my friend." In America, we are inclined to celebrate tastemakers who are utterly lacking in taste. Not all of us, of course. Back in May of 2000, Clarence Page, Washington columnist for the Chicago Tribune, asked Imus to take a pledge.
Are you raising your hand?
Yeah. I have it up.
Okay, number one, I, Don Imus. Do solemnly swear. That I will promise to cease all simian references to black athletes. A ban on all references to non-criminal blacks as thugs, pimps, muggers, and Colt 45 drinkers.
I promise to do that.
Very good. How about an end to Amos and Andy Cutts, comparison of New York City to Mogadishu, and all parodies of black voices unless they are done by a black person because you're really not very good at it?
The pledge was immediately and inevitably broken. But for Page, that wasn't the point. The point was to make his position clear. He liked being on the serious part of Imus in the Morning, he told us a few years back, but he didn't want his presence to imply endorsement of the outrages committed in the other part.
I personally feel that I and other pundits should not go on if we have serious objections to some of the show's material, unless Don does give us the opportunity to address those concerns, as he did with me. Now, why I haven't been invited on the show since, I don't know. I haven't troubled myself to call and ask.
Imus didn't need Page. He had a roster of willing guests.
The reason I go on his show is very, very simple.
Frank Rich is a New York Times columnist, and he was an Imus regular. I spoke to him back in 2001, obviously not about this incident, but countless others, like when Imus made fun of the Parkinson's tremors of Clinton Attorney General Janet Reno, or when he described reporter Gwen Ifill as a cleaning lady. But Rich said that wasn't all there was to Imus.
It's the only show I know of in commercial broadcasting that I've been on where you can actually talk in an informed way, not in sound bites, about the issue of the day with someone with whom you can match wits and who really knows his stuff. For the space when he's talking to a journalist or a politician or an author, you know, it plays to me like Terry Gross, quite frankly.
But if the serious parts were Terry Gross, then the satire, according to Rich, was closer to Alfred E. Newman.
It plays as a sometimes juvenile speech at the level of, say, Mad Magazine or Paul Krasner's The Realist, which is what it aspires to and hits and misses. I don't feel by appearing on the show that I'm endorsing the worst offenders, but also I feel in the context of entertainment, to me, it plays in context in the show. It doesn't play as hate speech.
Maybe, but in a 1997 interview with Mike Wallace, Imus admitted that he hired some staff to make racist jokes.
You told Tom Anderson, the producer, in your car coming home, that Bernard McGurk is there to do nigger jokes.
Well, I never used that word.
Tom?
I'm right here.
Did I use that word?
I recall you using that word.
Oh, okay, well then I used that word. But I mean, of course that was an off-the-record conversation.
The hell it was.
Back in 2001, I asked Mike Wallace why, knowing all that, he still went on the show.
There's a lot more to Imus than sophomoric and bigoted talk. A lot more. As I said, he reads, he thinks, he has an audience in Washington, I know, of all manner of, I hate to use the word important people, but in effect they are people in the establishment there. And they listen. It's a kind of club, in effect. It's early morning, shaving in the mirror, taking your mind off your troubles talk. What you're doing when you listen to that kind of thing, or go on, and you're not going after votes.
What are you going after?
Public recognition of a sort. That's the world we live in, Ms. Gladstone.
And especially the public recognition of young men, the kind of audience advertisers crave. Last year, Imus reportedly made $11 million for his New York station alone. That can buy a lot of insulation. But it's not bulletproof. Powerful friends and piles of cash couldn't protect Trent Lott. And though Ann Coulter doesn't seem to have suffered much for slurring John Edwards, Ann Coulter is, after all, a joke. Imus makes jokes. Bad ones. This latest was particularly bad, costing him not just a few of his regular guests, but some of his big sponsors, including Procter & Gamble and American Express. And to his network bosses, whatever they may have thought of his humor, that was no laughing matter.
Meanwhile, as of this moment, the offending minute-long clip taken from MSNBC's simulcast of the Imus in the Morning radio program has been viewed hundreds of thousands of times on YouTube. Like it or not, this has become a national conversation mediated largely by cable television and the Internet. But what exactly is this conversation about? Leon Winter, author of American Skin, says that Imus misappropriated a black expression and chose a particularly bad target in the Lady Scarlet Knights of Rutgers.
How they play the game and the passion and the purity of it. They work very, very hard at that image. I think that anyone who watched any part of that tournament is especially outraged. I mean, these would be the perfect victims.
Part of this flap has to do, it seems to me, with cultural appropriation. Black slang having had such a pervasive influence on the larger culture that even older, extremely white guys like Don Imus think they can borrow it and be hip, or at least current. Is that partly what's at issue here? Who gets to use which terms?
It is, but I think we should be clear. It's much deeper than slang. The very term nappy-headed points to this very long sense of belittlement in the face of European standards of beauty. And for the very longest time, African Americans in general, black women in particular, have struggled with this question of the appearance of their hair. Just in one deft and very ugly sentence, Imus managed to put his hands right under our collective wig.
It's a black thing, and not everybody has the permission to get into it, no matter how much the question of hair, good hair, as the saying goes, and nappy hair may undergird the cultural conversation among blacks.
Well, you know, that's at one level. You can't use those words. You can't appropriate our particular pain. But at the same time, we defend the right both amongst ourselves and also commercially for those of us who happen to be rappers, comedians, etc. I have a strong feeling that we can no longer maintain that wall. Too many people, including in right-wing talk radio, are pointing out the hypocrisy of saying, well, we can say it, and we can even make money saying it, but he can't.
Now, I'm Jewish, and I tell some Jew jokes, and I got to tell you, some of them are just absolutely fabulous. And I like hearing them from other Jews, but when I hear one from a Gentile, you know, my antenna are immediately up and sometimes my eyebrows too, because I'm trying to figure out what right has this person to tell that joke? Is it anti-Semitic? I get a little suspicious. Is this the same phenomenon we're discussing?
It is in a sense. We're talking about the arc of arrival, if you will, in American culture. you had Jewish comedians, making for a long time a good portion of the Jewish populace uncomfortable. However, over time, I think you can safely say that most of Jewish America feels they can afford it. The real issue, though, is can Black America now afford its particular brand of self-deprecating humor? It's as if, as much as Black America has arrived, the commodification of this aspect of Black culture has far outstripped our advances within the society as a whole.
Since this story broke and since this phrase has become part of the national vernacular, I personally, in my joking communications with just about everyone, have called them a nappy-headed hoe. And everybody laughs. Do I have permission to do that? Not from you, but from, say, the culture at large?
I don't think so. If I were David Letterman, or certainly Bob Garfield, or any number of people who are hip and with it and so on, they're going to have to find a new way of actually certifying their hipness and their coolness besides sort of appropriating these things that they don't necessarily understand the impact of. Before the I must, as I call it, the idea was that you had relatively little at stake for playing this game, for sort of, you know, bumping up your hipness quotient by dropping whatever it was. Now I think the stakes are a lot higher.
You're right. So henceforth, in my little personal email jokes, I'll just start calling people schlemiels. I should be safe there. Leon, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure, Bob.
Leon Winter is the author of American Skin, Pop Culture, Big Business, and the End of White America. His blog, The American Race, will be linked to at onthemedia.org.
Coming up on the eve of Earth Day, a look back at Rachel Carson and the good side of global warming.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Last week, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, released the second installment of its 2007 report, a report which states with 90% certainty that human activities are driving climate change. That has cut the ground out from under the feet of such groups as the Competitive Enterprise Institute, or CEI, which was in the business of denying that humans played a major part in global warming. But CEI could tell which way the scientific wind was blowing and last year toned down its denial of humanity's role in climate change and spearheaded an ad campaign to play up the idea that carbon dioxide is good for you.
The fuels that produce CO2 have freed us from a world of backbreaking labor, lighting up our lives, allowing us to create and move the things we need. The people we love. Now some politicians want to label carbon dioxide a pollutant. Imagine if they succeed. What would our lives be like then? Carbon dioxide. They call it pollution. We call it life.
Since that ad was produced, CEI's legislative allies have been voted out of power in Congress, so the group has had to find more and better arguments to fend off restrictions on energy use. It's argued that rich countries have no right to clamp down on poor ones, that carbon caps would unfairly target the developing world. And it has never ceased pointing out that warming has a good side. We heard that again this week when we called up the Competitive Enterprise Institute's president, Fred Smith.
If I was a Siberian, the idea of having sunny days might be very appealing to me. Also, growth seasons will last longer. CO2 is a plant nutrient. But of course, as you should know, in the report, there's also arguments that there might be some negative effects. When anything changes, there are some pluses and some minuses. The report tends to focus on the negatives, but it focuses on some positives, too.
Well, it's just that the idea reminds me of the movie Superman. Lex Luthor wants to send California into the Pacific Ocean, so his land in Nevada will be beachfront. I mean, at some point, doesn't it become absurd to look at the silver lining in a cloud that could, you know, devastate the planet?
Oh, well, will this devastate the planet? Most of the studies show relatively small losses for the planet. And those losses are severe because poverty is still too great a part of the world. The storms that hit Florida are not different than the storms that hit Bangladesh, but the consequences are very different because the resiliency of wealthy, technologically adroit societies is better. We have warnings. We can move out of harm's way. We have our SUVs, our vans, or even our Priuses, depending on what you think is most appropriate. And we have insurance and other things that allow us to go back. And if Bangladesh were more like Florida, there would be a lot less worry about the risk of climate change. Part of the answer, and the IPCC report does not disagree with this, part of the answer is making the world more adaptable, more resilient. And the point we make is that that requires that we use more, not less energy. And today, that means more carbon-based energy, and that means more CO2, not less CO2.
I want to just go back in time about a year and talk about your organization's ad campaign about carbon dioxide. The thrust of the campaign was to remind Americans that carbon dioxide is an important building block of life. What were you trying to get at there?
Well, maybe something a bit too complicated. You certainly can't articulate a lot of intellectual points in an ad. But the attempt there was to explain that CO2 is an inevitable part of a better life for most of the people in the world. And attempts to suppress CO2 will mean suppressing a better life for people in the world we live in today. It's possible that in the future, there may be energy sources that are affordable that will rely on other ways of creating energy that will be more available, more affordable than carbon-based fuels. But those aren't available today. I mean, I've met Al Gore. I respect his position. But I think it's somewhat obscene for wealthy people in America and Europe to tell the poor people of the world that we want them to stop using energy.
It's my view, and I think it's fair to say it's the institutional view of this program, that CEI has actually been the beneficiary of a certain kind of journalism that attempts to lend balance to any story by going to someone from the political opposition, irrespective of whether the opposing voice has equal weight. Now, do you perceive a change in the way that journalists are covering your organization?
They're giving us a lot more attention, not altogether favorable. The Vanity Fair has an article about one of my staffers this time, and it's kind of like a Demon of the World award or something like that. There's always an attempt, in a sense, to simplify, to demonize groups you disagree with and you think are wrong. But in a sense, these are issues that will have tremendous consequences for the people of the world. There will be great sufferings involved as energy becomes more expensive. It seems to me that someone should say that before you decide to make energy less affordable, we should stop and listen. And you have to decide whether what we say has any rationale or not. I mean, we think we're serious, but obviously we would, wouldn't we?
Obviously you would. Fred, I very much appreciate you joining us.
Glad to be on it.
Fred Smith is the founder and president of the Competitive Enterprise Institute.
The Competitive Enterprise Institute may be adapting to new scientific realities, but how about the scientists themselves? Not really, according to a short article in the current issue of Science magazine. In it, American University communications professor Matthew Nisbet and science journalist Chris Mooney argue that scientists have done a poor job of getting their message across, and that if they really want to convey the implications of their research, they need to focus more on framing, recasting their message in terms the lay public can really relate to. Climate change, says Nisbet, is a perfect example. Once it was an issue of not enough coverage, but now he says we have a different problem.
The problem is that when you actually look at the opinion polls, you have what I describe as a two Americas of public perceptions on the issue. 75% of college-educated Democrats accept that human activities are contributing to climate change. On the other hand, only roughly a quarter of college-educated Republicans accept that science. And so what's going on here? It's because several Democratic leaders like Al Gore and even some scientists are really adopting what I call the catastrophe frame or the Pandora's box frame, really focusing in on specific climate impacts that might be scary or frightening, such as the possibility of more intense hurricanes. When you move in that direction where the science is still uncertain, you open yourself up to the counterargument that this is just simply alarmism. It's very easy for the public then to simply rely on their partisanship to make up their minds, and that's why you have this two Americas of public perception.
So that's a political reality. But what is it that you're asking the scientists to do? How are they supposed to change the way they present it in order to confront this political reality?
You start recasting the issue in ways that are still true to the science, but in fact, actually, you're not talking about the science. You're engaging with business leaders and CEOs that are talking about the promise for innovative technology, again, the market potential for that, that might activate that moderate Republican base that reads the Wall Street Journal and says, hey, suddenly I care about global warming because there might be investment potential here. You recast the issue as really a moral duty, not just in a religious sense, but saying, look, this is like credit card debt. We're passing the buck on to future generations if we don't do something now. The science is there. This is an urgent problem. We need to take action.
So you're actually calling on scientists to become advocates or even activists?
Well, you know, I don't think it's politically controversial to say that the first thing is to activate interest, to activate concern, so that people can start paying attention to the science, to remain true to the science, but recast it in a light that connects to their backgrounds.
But it seems, you know, pretty easy to do it about climate change, where there is so much consensus. But what about issues where there isn't? Nuclear energy, for instance, or cancer research. How can scientists effectively frame their findings when there's active disagreement among them over what the implications of the research are?
Sure. Two other really good examples on that front would be plant biotechnology and nanotechnology. Scientists still have some lingering disagreements about both the human safety and also the environmental safety of nanotech and areas of plant biotechnology. The real danger there, for example, like an emerging technology like nanotechnology, is that one frame gets locked in. And the frame that can always be locked in is this idea of a Pandora's box, that somehow this Frankenstein's monster, this technology is out of control, and it's going to lead to catastrophe somewhere down the road. So scientists have to think carefully, how do we offer alternative interpretations that are true to the science but don't lead to some type of rash reaction from the public that might unlock greater interest or greater understanding or actually motivate people to inform themselves about the science?
What's been the reaction from scientists themselves to your paper?
Generally very positive. On the other hand, there's a small corner of the blogosphere, people that feel very intensely about the particular issue of teaching evolution. Many of them prefer sort of the Richard Dawkins school of communication. They believe that science in kind of its absolute form is the only way to communicate about the teaching of evolution. In fact, actually, the scientific worldview will eventually perhaps displace people's religious views. And unfortunately, that's a view that becomes very polarizing. In fact, it feeds into a norm that the media favors, and that's the conflict frame. It really feeds into this science versus religion frame, and you'll see magazine covers and news stories, you know, talking about science versus religion.
But when you get down to it, it's impossible for scientists to appeal to those who think that God created the earth in 7 days.
Well, certainly, you're always going to have a certain segment of the public that hold to these very strong creationist views. On the other hand, you have a very important kind of swing public on this issue. People that are moderately religious, who are actually from faith traditions where their religious leaders endorse the teaching of evolution in schools and don't see it in conflict with their religious beliefs. But if somehow through interpersonal conversation or they see something in the media about how this is really boils down to a science versus religion issue and that really the teaching of evolution is really just about getting atheism into the schools, you're not going to win them over.
How would you have advised Copernicus to advance his highly controversial and unpopular sun-centered theory of the solar system?
Well, again, you know, there's certain ideas that come about in science that clash so strongly against prevailing worldviews that any type of short-term communication effort is going to run up against a wall. What I'm really talking about is on these short-term issues where there needs to be a policy decision made in the next 5 years, the next 10 years, during the presidential election cycle, what's the best way to engage the public by way of the media? And certainly, you can't get around the idea that framing is central to that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Matthew Nisbett teaches at the American University School of Communication. We'll link to his Science magazine piece at onthemedia.org.
One scientist whose framing changed the way our country thought of nature and business was Rachel Carson.
We spray our elms, and the following springs are silent of robin song, not because we sprayed the robins directly, but because the poison traveled step by step through the now familiar elm leaf earthworm robin cycle. These are matters of record, observable, part of the visible world around us. They reflect the web of life or death that scientists know as ecology.
In 1962, the biologist Rachel Carson published her seminal ecological work, Silent Spring, about the widespread and irresponsible use of chemical pesticides. At the time, the brash scientist was likened to Carrie Nation, wielding her reverence for nature like an axe. Now, in the centennial of her birth and a week from Earth Day, she is revered as the mother of modern environmentalism. In the face of all we don't know about science, Carson called for humility and caution, and above all, a sense of wonder. Late in her life, Carson wrote an essay for Woman's Home Companion called Helping Your Child to Wonder. In it, she urges, quote, "If a child is to keep alive his inborn sense of wonder, he needs the companionship of at least one adult who can share it, rediscovering with him the joy, excitement, and mystery of the world we live in." Gary Kroll has written about Rachel Carson. He's an assistant professor of environmental history at Plattsburgh State University, and he joins me now. Gary, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you for having me, Bob.
Please refresh our memories about her central premise. It involved the pesticide DDT and how it lingered in ecosystems, even if it didn't necessarily do so in the human body.
Well, it comes out of a court case, really, in the late 1950s that was out in Long Island, where you had a whole bunch of people that were being sprayed indiscriminately on farms, on people's little gardens, and it was the USDA that was trying to eradicate various pests, and they wanted to file a suit to pass an injunction. And a gentleman named Robert Cushman Murphy, who was a naturalist at the American Museum of Natural History, contacted Carson and said, hey, why don't you get involved with this? So she started with a very small piece in 1958, I believe, and it just spiraled into a much bigger book about how pesticides that come out of the post-war research period are being used a little too carelessly.
Now, Silent Spring appeared in various forms. At first, it was a series of magazine pieces in The New Yorker, which morphed into a book of the same title, and still later showed up as a TV documentary, I believe, on CBS.
Right. The CBS Reports version is, in my mind, the most interesting because, you know, in many ways, it's not just Rachel Carson's Silent Spring. It's also Eric Severide and the producers of the film. That final format, you really do see this kind of contest between science and anti-science, where you see this wonderful gentleman. He works for American Cyanamid, and he's in this white lab coat with these thick glasses. He looks like a splendid scientist, and he would talk about why Rachel Carson is woefully ignorant on certain issues. And then the film would cut to Rachel Carson, and she's sitting in her rocking chair and talking about the arrogance of science. And what strikes out very, very clearly from the documentary is the interviews with the government officials, the health officials, and the USDA, the many people who really had tremendous ignorance that they admitted. We do not know the long-term effects on the human body. We do not know the long-term effects on the water supply. This is one scene where you hear constantly, we don't know, we don't know, we don't know.
Now, there is a great temptation to say, ah, Silent Spring, 1962, it took the radical notion of environmentalism and made it mainstream. But you say not so fast on that one, huh?
The mainstreaming of environmentalism actually doesn't happen until 1970. When you look at the first Earth Day, April 22nd, 1970, and it's at that point where this environmentalism that in the 1960s was quite radical, that kind of falls to the wayside, that militantism, that radicalism, and it becomes almost popular to be an environmentalist in the 1970s. And the moment of this radical ecology coming to fruition dies in a way, and it becomes the job of governments and schools to take care of the environment.
If Silent Spring did not necessarily represent the mainstreaming of environmentalism, it did seem to be on the leading edge of something else, and that is just the permission to question authority in the society. It was clustered around Ralph Nader suing General Motors and
right. The
Vietnam War. Do you believe that it was pivotal in the whole way that American society regards its own assumptions?
Yes, I do. You put your faith and your trust in people. You put your faith in the government and the USDA in the 1950s, let's say.
And American Cyanamid.
Exactly, yes, exactly. Science and the government and American corporations. You put your faith in there. And then what she says, and this is very startling for many readers in 1960s, don't trust them. they haven't earned that trust yet. They may someday, and she really wants them to earn that trust, but they haven't done it yet, and they may be hurting the public body.
If Rachel Carson were around today to see how the ecological movement has evolved, do you think she'd be proud, satisfied, disgusted? What?
I ask myself that question every single day, and I think she would look at children and their wonderful sense of optimism, and she would be just absolutely overjoyed with what we do with teaching environmental ethics when our kids are young. And then when she sees us getting older, I think that's where her remorse would build in, and she would say, my goodness, why can't we act as children again, and why can't we just enjoy that sense of wonder that she liked to talk about so much? So she certainly would have a mixed reaction.
All right, Gary, thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure, Bob.
Gary Kroll is an assistant professor of history at Plattsburgh State University and author of a new book titled Exploration and Science.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org, and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney has raised $23 million in presidential campaign funds, more than any other Republican. It was a high-profile success for a Mormon politician, and when the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints let its longtime PR firm go recently, many thought they might be hoping to capitalize on Romney's success. Good PR, after all, has been a slippery thing for the country's fourth largest denomination. The Mormon Tabernacle Choir and the 2002 Winter Olympics, which first lofted Mitt Romney to a national stage, are obvious Mormon successes. But waiting until 1978 to desegregate the church, not so much. Richard Osling, co-author of Mormon America, The Power and the Promise, says that in the face of declining membership, Romney may be ushering in the Mormon's moment. Richard, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, Romney isn't the first prominent Mormon in national politics, right? I mean, his father ran against Nixon in 68. There was Morris Udall, the Democratic senator from Arizona, who ran against Carter in 76. There's Orrin Hatch, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid. How important a moment is this for the Mormon Church?
Well, there's no doubt that the Romney candidacy is a big moment for the Mormon American, because he probably has a shot at the presidential or vice presidential nomination. And I think it's fair to say that no previous Mormon has. At the same time, as you mentioned, Harry Reid has emerged as by far the most powerful Mormon to hold public office in this country. He doesn't have as high a profile as a Mormon because Romney held important church positions, but it's interesting these two figures have emerged simultaneously in a sense, because it shows, though Mormons tend to be very Republican and very conservative on the whole in their voting patterns, nevertheless, the church doesn't have a political ideology as such.
You know, polls show that many Americans don't know anything about the church, and most of what they do know is wrong. Can you give us a quick primer on Mormon belief?
Boy, that's a complicated question, but we could start with polygamy. I think folks have a general confusion about it. You know, don't these folks or didn't they practice polygamy? Part of the problem is, of course, that there are splinter groups which do practice polygamy. In fact, the church outlawed or ended polygamy in 1890, but it was established by the founding prophet, Joseph Smith. So it is part of the Mormon heritage in a general sense, and Mitt Romney and many others have polygamous forebears back in the 19th century.
His great-grandfather had five wives, right?
Yes, it certainly is a problem. I mean, they're at pains to make the point that we haven't practiced it for well over 100 years. This does provide the church a chance to sort of make its case and explain itself, and I think there'll be a lot of public interest.
Yes, it's a teachable moment. On the other hand, once you look into Mormonism, it can seem awfully wacky to the believers of more mainstream faiths, mostly because a lot of the founding myths occurred in such recent history.
Yes, that's certainly true. I mean, the Mormon founder made the astonishing claim that Christianity essentially vanished from the face of the earth fairly soon after Jesus' lifetime and had to be restored by the American prophet. And indeed, these are things that are said to have happened right here in the United States in the 19th century, the receiving of golden tablets, new revelations alongside the Bible. The tablets and were taken by the angels, so we don't have them. His view of God and of Jesus Christ and any number of other things would be at variance from your typical American churchgoer.
Do you find it sort of funny that Romney, who needs to appeal to the evangelical voter and Christian conservatives generally in order to win the nomination, will have a problem potentially because those people, though they may share his values, don't in some cases see Mormonism as Christianity?
Yeah, that's going to be a really interesting question. It's significant at this point in the campaign that the attacks on Romney on religious terms have come from liberal and secular writers and commentators. I don't know of any important evangelical Protestant leader who has said, I don't want a Mormon in the White House. They've pretty much been saying the opposite. However, the polls indicate a lot of wariness in the American population about having a Mormon president, and there's no doubt that there are evangelicals counted among those people. So it's just kind of a moment of truth, I guess you'd say, for a lot of American religious groups.
Now, you've said that Romney has yet to have his JFK moment. What do you mean by that?
Well, in the 1960 campaign, there was a huge religious issue. We had never had a non-Protestant as president. So Kennedy made a famous speech in Houston to a ministerial association, and he told all these Protestant folks,
"So it is apparently necessary for me to state once again, not what kind of church I believe in, for that should be important only to me, but what kind of America I believe in. I believe in an America where the separation of church and state is absolute, where no Catholic prelate would tell the president, should he be Catholic, how to act, and no Protestant minister would tell his parishioners for whom to vote."
It was a brilliant address. Now, everybody's saying, well, is Romney going to give a similar address? People seem to be saying he ought to do it, but there are no firm signs that he intends to.
We have one example of that reluctance to engage when Judy Woodruff posed this question to him last year on PBS.
There are some aspects of Mormonism that many Americans might not understand. The belief that Jesus Christ will appear again in the state of Missouri, or that God has a material body, that he was fathered by another God. Are these legitimate issues for people to ask you about?
Well, there's a leap of faith associated with every religion. You haven't exactly got those doctrines right, but if you have doctrines you want to talk about, go talk to the church, because that's not my job.
He may be calculating that it's better just to kind of low-key it, but I think the polls show enough nervousness at this point that if I were advising him politically, I'd probably say, you know, you really have to tackle this thing and deal with the questions that are swirling around the internet.
Richard, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Richard Ostling and his wife Joan are completing an updated edition of Mormon America, The Power and the Promise.
For while this year it may be a Catholic against whom the finger of suspicion is pointed, in other years it has been, and may someday be again, a Jew, or a Quaker, or a Unitarian, or a Baptist. It was Virginia's harassment of Baptist preachers, for example, that led to Jefferson's Statute of Religious Freedom.
Not long ago, morning commuters at Washington, D.C.'s L'Enfant Plaza metro stop rushed from their trains to their jobs to a musical accompaniment. A street busker was standing in the covered plaza just outside the station, sawing away on his violin. The commuters didn't seem to notice. They certainly didn't notice that the violinist was Joshua Bell, the famed soloist who this week was awarded the Avery Fisher Prize for Outstanding Achievement in Classical Music. The stunt was the brainchild of Washington Post writer Gene Weingarten, who wanted to see if the rat race so deadens the soul as to inure us to genuine beauty. Writing about the Josh Bell experiment in last Sunday's Washington Post magazine, Weingarten said the nearly universal indifference was a sight to behold.
There were about 1,100 people who walked by. Exactly 7 stayed to listen for at least a minute. 27 threw in money for a grand total of $32.17. And yes, that does mean that people gave pennies. And what was really most astonishing was that the vast majority of the people who walked by didn't even look at him. It was as though he were a nuisance to be avoided.
Buskers actually are not permitted within metro facilities in Washington. So seeing one at the subway is not a common occurrence for Washington commuters. And furthermore, this was not your ordinary busker. Let me just please play a passage from Joshua Bell's performance.
Bell plays a $4 million Stradivarius made in 1713. And we had this in a little arcade at the top of the escalator. It bounced that music right back and really gave it some reverb. It sounded symphonic.
So your piece went to some lengths to divine what was going on there as people, one after another, passed by one of the greatest living violinists. What are the possible explanations, and in the end, what do you think was happening that day?
Yeah, I drew some conclusions, and one conclusion was that it would be unfair to say that these people were unsophisticated boobs. They were basically people in a hurry. The ones I talked to who barely remembered that they had passed a musician essentially said that. They had a job to get to, they were late for a training seminar, whatever. The thing that I did ultimately conclude here is that there's a problem with this, with being so busy that you're blind to something this extraordinary that's happening 8 feet away from you. The piece quoted a guy, he was a hobo in London in 1917. He wrote a poem that begins, "What is this life if full of care we have not time to stand and stare?" His name was W.H. Davies. And, you know, that's essentially what he was talking about.
Well, it raises the question, among others, about whether beauty really exists in a vacuum, how much context affects the way we react to anything aesthetic. Having watched this with your own eyes, do you believe that the fundamental nature of beauty actually changes when it is taken out of a concert hall and put into a subway plaza?
I don't think the nature of beauty changes. I think our ability to appreciate it definitely changes. One of the people I talked to in the story is the guy who is in charge of framing the paintings at the National Gallery. And he said he would have predicted this, absolutely predicted it. The example he gave that I just loved was, you know, what if he took a great painting from the National Gallery, something that's not completely representational, a little abstract, took it out of its frame, marched it down the 52 steps that people have to walk up to get to the National Gallery, past those giant columns, walked into a restaurant in Georgetown, the kind of place that has original art on the walls with $150 price tags, put that on the wall. Let's say it's an Ellsworth Kelly, you know, worth about $5, $6 million. And what he said would happen is nobody would notice it. And even an art curator might look up at the wall and say, "Boy, that looks just like an Ellsworth Kelly. Please pass the salt."
A number of people wrote to you in your online chat and said that they had wept as they read your piece, and they wept for the loss of beauty or for the loss of our ability to appreciate it anyway.
The mail was quite remarkable on this. There was a woman who wrote to me. She's a government lawyer. And she said she read this story and wept. And because of it, she has decided to change her career, to do something not that she needs to do to make money, but that she wants to do because she's always dreamed of it. I don't know what that is, but that one made me tear up a little bit.
The obvious question would be for me to ask how this has affected you as a writer, having witnessed this, and how it's made you reevaluate your work and your life. But I'm not going to. I'm going to ask you as a last question. What did Josh Bell have to say when he was finished playing to a completely uninterested audience?
Josh and I had breakfast afterwards, and he was laughing at himself. This is not a pompous guy. And, you know, when he performs at a concert hall, he said, you know, I'll get kind of upset if somebody coughs or a cell phone goes off. But after a few minutes here, I found my expectations really diminishing. And he said he was wretchedly grateful when somebody, like, threw in a dollar instead of a quarter.
Wonderful. Well, Gene, thank you very, very much.
Good. It was good to be here.
Gene Weingarten is a humor columnist for The Washington Post and a staff writer for The Washington Post magazine.
This is Kurt Vonnegut, WNYC's reporter on the afterlife. During yesterday's controlled near-death experience, I had the pleasure of
one of the last things Kurt Vonnegut wrote was a collection of essays written from the pearly gates, or what he described as the 100 yards or so of vacant lot between the far end of the blue tunnel and the pearly gates. As he explained it on the radio and in the book God Bless You, Dr. Kevorkian, Vonnegut would be strapped to a gurney at the lethal injection facility in Huntsville, Texas, rendered by the good doctor mostly but not altogether dead, and dispatched to interview the famous and not-so-famous deceased, ranging from a bar owner and a teacher to Isaac Newton, James Earl Ray, William Shakespeare, Hitler. On the Media has a special affection for this work by the late, great Vonnegut because, as you heard, he conducted these interviews as a reporter for our producing station, WNYC.
During what has been almost a year of interviewing completely dead people while only half dead myself, I asked St. Peter again and again to meet a particular hero of mine. He is my fellow Hoosier, the late Eugene Victor Debs of Terre Haute, Indiana. He was 5 times the Socialist Party's candidate for president back when this country still had a strong Socialist Party. And then, guess what? Yesterday afternoon, none other than Eugene Victor Debs, organizer and leader of the first successful strike against a major American industry, the railroads, was waiting for me at the far end of the blue tunnel. We hadn't met before. This great American died in 1926 at the age of 71, when I was only 4 years old. I thanked him for words of his, which I quote again and again in lectures. As long as there is a lower class, I am in it. As long as there is a criminal element, I am of it. As long as there is a soul in prison, I am not free. He asked me how those words were received here on earth in America nowadays. I said they were ridiculed. People snicker and snort, I said. He asked what our fastest growing industry was. The building of prisons, I said. What a shame, he said. And then he asked me, how is the Sermon on the Mount going over these days? And then he spread his wings and he flew away.
I say in speeches, Vonnegut said, that a plausible mission of artists is to make people appreciate being alive at least a little bit. I am then asked if I know of any artists who pulled that off. I reply, the Beatles did. Well, obviously, not just the Beatles.
The That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Christopher Worth, Peter Garner, and Andy Lancet. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.